Ce sont les puristes du blues, Fleetwood Mac.
Over the course of just 1 year, 1974, British blues rock band Fleetwood Mac would go from a career low point by any measure, the bottom of the barrel, a punchline to their peers, to suddenly, by year's end, transformed, reinvented, and ready to become one of the most successful, top-selling acts of all time.
The roots of Fleetwood Mac go back to May 1966, when drummer Mick Fleetwood, ex the Chaneys and the Bow Street Runners, played for the first time with guitarist Peter Green in an instrumental outfit called Peter B's Lunars, later known as Shotgun Express. By July, Peter Green had left Shotgun Express to replace Eric Clapton in the legendary John Mayall's Bluesbreakers, which led to a close alliance with the Bluesbreakers bass guitarist John McVie. The subsequent studio record, Hard Road, gave the Bluesbreakers another top 10 hit album. By April 1967, Mick Fleetwood had also joined the Bluesbreakers, reuniting him with Peter Green and used some free studio time to record Double Trouble, featuring Peter Green, Mick Fleetwood, and John McVie playing together for the first time.
Fleetwood Mac was formed in 1967. Led by singer-guitarist Peter Green for its first 3 years, the group during that time also included two other singer-guitarists, Jeremy Spencer and Danny Kirwan, plus drummer Mick Fleetwood and bass player John McVie.
John Mayall had given Peter Green a birthday present which amounted to a few hours studio time. And during that session, Peter recorded an instrumental which was called Fleetwood Mac, mainly because me and John were playing on it. So when he formed the band, he just chose the name Fleetwood Mac.
This era brought Fleetwood Mac half a dozen British hits, including Black Magic Woman and this one, the soulful Need Your Love So Bad.
Need someone's hand to lead me through the night. I need someone's arms to hold and squeeze me tight. Now when the night begins, I'm out of end. Because I need your love so bad.
Albatross was the biggest hit for the early Fleetwood Mac. It topped the British chart in 1968 and returned to the top three 5 years later when it was re-released, although by then Peter Green had left the group.
Emotionally, he wasn't up to and didn't want to continue being involved with any sort of commitment at all, whether it be music or people. And he just withdrew, quite literally. He stayed at home for the better part of 3 years and hardly ever went out, actually.
Oh, well.
In May 1970, Peter Green left the group he had founded. After a few weeks as a quartet, John McVie's wife Christine, a singer and keyboard player who had tasted chart success with Chicken Shack, was recruited to join her husband in Fleetwood Mac. The next 4 years saw Fleetwood Mac undergoing several personnel changes. Spencer and Kirwan left the band, as did several other musicians, most of whom joined only briefly. Mick Fleetwood and the McVies struggled to recapture Fleetwood Mac's previous chart success and finally decided to base themselves in California, where there appeared to be more interest in the group.
Johnny Walker here on Sounds of the 70s, joined in the studio by Elmer Gantry and Kirby Gregory. Elmer, that's quite a name you got there. How did you get that?
Well, in the 60s, I had a band called Elmer Gantry's Velvet Opera, and that was the name of the band. What actually happened was that because people come back after the gig and I was the lead singer, people would assume that I was Elmer, which amused the rest of the band. So they basically started, you know, taking the rise and calling me Elmer as a joke.
Now, you two are famous for being in the band Stretch, also played in Curved Air, mm-hmm. but there was a bit of a debacle going on in America with a certain famous group called Fleetwood Mac. I've got to ask you about that.
Yeah.
So what happened there?
Well, it's a very complicated story. I mean, what happened, Elmer and I were invited to join Fleetwood Mac.
Not the real Fleetwood Mac.
Well, the real Fleetwood Mac.
Kirby and I were working together. We had a manager who managed Fleetwood Mac. Fleetwood Mac had a big bust up.
This was in America, and Mick had gone back to England, had he?
Mick came back. Well, I think the English ones came back to England. And so the manager suggested that we form the new Fleetwood Mac, and it seemed reasonable. Kirby had just left Curved Air. Was well known. I was well known from Elmer Gantry's Velvet Opera. We both had sort of kudos in the business, so it seemed like a logical thing. Mick Fleetwood came to our house, and we talked through the new band, and it all seemed fine. And Mick said, "Well, I can't actually come and rehearse with you because it was fairly imminent going back to America to tour. But if you get an adept drummer, I'll join you for the tour." We all knew the numbers inside out. We picked all sort of tracks that Mick was happy with and that we were happy with. And in the event, we turned up in the States and Mick didn't turn up. We heard stories about, we have no idea who these people are who are pretending to be us. And it wasn't until about 3 years ago that somebody sent me anonymously some court papers where in court in the 70s, Mick admitted that he'd been to our house and discussed Fleetwood Mac.
You have done to me. The damage is much deeper than you'll ever see. Hit me like a hammer to my head. I wonder were you pushed or were you led? Why did you do it? Why did you do that thing to me? Why did you do it? Why did you do that thing to me? The only one who knows the truth, man, that's him, me and you.
Fleetwood Mac was formed by blues guitarist Peter Green in 1968, after he left John Mayall's Bluesbreakers, in which he had replaced Eric Clapton, to form his own band, with drummer Mick Fleetwood, guitarist Jeremy Spencer, and bassist Bob Brunning. Brunning was soon replaced by John McVie, Green and Fleetwood's former bandmate in the Bluesbreakers. Fleetwood Mac was successful, and Green eventually added a third guitar player, Danny Kirwan, and also enlisted the services of a manager, Clifford Davis. But Peter Green swiftly became disillusioned with the trappings of success and fame, the inherent self-indulgence and narcissism that he saw as embodiments of the star treatment. He was highly respected and very talented, but he decided the music business wasn't for him.
Peter was incredibly generous. He was the leader of the band, and he put this band together. Peter was asked, why did he call the band Fleetwood Mac? He said, well, you know, I thought maybe I would move on at some point, and I wanted Mick and John to have a band. End of story. Explaining how generous he was. Drive me mad.
Without Green, Fleetwood Mac still had two guitarists, so they replaced him with a piano player and singer named Christine Perfect, a contemporary from the blues rock band Chicken Shack, and also the bass player's wife. The entire band, minus Green, purchased a Victorian mansion called Benefold, and they all moved in. But it seems that being in Fleetwood Mac was a curse for a guitar player. First came Jeremy Spencer's reckoning. According to one account by Mick Fleetwood, Spencer had difficulty recovering from a mescaline trip while on tour in the US. Shortly before the band was set to travel from San Francisco to Los Angeles, LA experienced a major earthquake. Spencer was freaking out and didn't want to go. He had bad premonitions and was very apprehensive. He pleaded with the band to call off the trip, but they went. Shortly after arriving in LA on the day of the gig at the Whiskey A Go Go, Spencer left the hotel and went to a bookshop on Hollywood Boulevard. He did not return, forcing the cancellation of the concert. Some days later, he was discovered to have joined a communal cult called the Children of God, founded by David Brant Berg. Berg communicated with his followers by writing letters. He published nearly 3,000 letters over a period of 24 years, referred to as the Mo Letters. By 1972, the Children of God had 130 communities around the world.
In 1973, Berg introduced a practice he calls flirty fishing. His older daughter, Deborah, who left the cult in the late 70s, explains the term.
Well, Dad got the terminology from fishing, what Jesus said in the Bible, to go out and fish for men. And so she was going to use the women to fish for the men, to bring the men to the kingdom of God through flirting. Only the flirting was more than flirting. It was actually, you know, religious prostitution.
According to Berg's daughter, Deborah, Berg himself has had an incestuous relationship with his other daughter, Faith, for years, although they both deny that's the case. In fact, a spokesman for Berg told 2020 that he does not advocate incest. Yet Deborah claims her father did approach her for sex, and that was the catalyst to her leaving the cult.
My dad was just an evil personality that was not hearing from God at all. I had to quit looking at him as the man as my father, but as a leader of a worldwide movement who was destroying people's lives.
With no choice but to leave Spencer behind, manager Clifford Davis convinced Peter Green to return to the band to finish the tour. But Green's return was only ever going to be temporary. He did it as a favor. So this is when American guitar player Bob Welch was recruited to join the band. Two more albums were released before the guitar player curse hit Danny Kirwan.
It is an autumn night in 1972, and minutes before Fleetwood Mac are due in on stage for their latest gig of their US tour, a drama is unfolding in their dressing room. Danny Kirwan, talented guitarist and the glamour boy of the band, is drunk. At just 22, he is an alcoholic who goes for days without food, existing only on beer. Increasingly mentally fragile, he suddenly loses his temper over the simple process of tuning a guitar. Banging the wall with his fists, he hurls his expensive Gibson Les Paul at a mirror, showering broken glass over his bandmates. He then stomps off into the auditorium, pausing only to smash his head against a wall until blood pours from his face. Refusing to come on stage, he spends the show heckling the band from the audience as they struggle to play without him.
Kirwan was replaced by guitarist Bob Weston, and Dave Walker from Savoy Brown also joined the band for one album. Walker soon departed, and later, in 1977, he would replace Ozzy Osbourne in Black Sabbath for a month. Bob Weston stayed on for the next album, Mystery to Me, and the subsequent U.S. tour. But during that tour, the curse hit again. Bob Weston had an affair with Mick Fleetwood's wife, Jenny.
It came to a head. I and Mick's wife at the time, Jenny, we were very best of friends. It was like at the time it was rather like a spiritual empathy, because if you believe in, from an astrologic point of view, we were born within an hour of each other. There's a kind of closeness. And we always communicated very well, and probably misread the language. We had a very brief affair.
Fleetwood was furious and wanted to call off the tour, despite manager Clifford Davis threatening, quote, "If you blow this tour, you'll never get another chance." Fleetwood didn't care. He fired Weston and canceled the tour. It was the fall of 1973, and Fleetwood Mac told Clifford Davis that they needed a break. But Clifford Davis didn't want to lose Fleetwood Mac's hard-won commercial momentum in the U.S., especially with a fresh album in the stores. In Bob Welch's words, quote, "I guess he just couldn't wait."
And we told him, "Look, we're coming off the road. Mick needs a rest. We got to sort this out. We don't want to work until we say we want to work. We don't want to make a record until we say. The band's not breaking up, but we don't know what we're going to do. I mean, everybody just needs a long rest. This is ridiculous. So look, just wait until you hear from it." So he was informed that was the situation, but it was like, I guess he couldn't wait.
Clifford Davis set out to put together a replacement band to send out on tour. And as the story goes, Mick Fleetwood initially agreed to participate. So in October of 1973, Clifford Davis recruited vocalist Elmer Gantry, formerly of Elmer Gantry's Velvet Opera, guitarist Kirby Gregory, from another act managed by Davis called Curved Air, bassist Paul Martinez from the Downliners sect, who years later would perform as a part of Led Zeppelin's backing band at Live Aid, and keyboardist John Wilkinson. The new band assembled a set list, which they claim Mick Fleetwood approved, and rehearsed. But when the time came for the U.S. tour that Davis had booked to begin, Mick Fleetwood went AWOL. He was a no-show. They recruited a drummer to replace him, Craig Collinge, who had played with the legendary heavy British rock band Third World War and was a member of Manfred Mann Chapter 3, the precursor to Manfred Mann's Earth Band. And so, a band calling itself Fleetwood Mac, but containing no actual members of Fleetwood Mac, set out on a U.S. tour. It was January of 1974. In a 2017 BBC radio interview, Elmer Gantry claimed that, quote, "Mick Fleetwood came to our house and we talked through the new band and it all seemed fine. But Mick said, well, I can't actually come to rehearse with you. But if you get a temporary drummer, I'll join you for the tour." Gantry added that he had recently seen court papers from the 70s in which Fleetwood testified that this meeting had taken place. Kirby Gregory, also interviewed, said that he and Gantry had played Little Feat's Dixie Chicken to Fleetwood as an example of the type of music they liked, and that Fleetwood gave his approval to the set list. The Fleetwood Mac tour began on January 16, 1974, at a venue in suburban Pittsburgh. The promoter of the show, Rich Engler, recounts in his autobiography that he had just formed a new concert promotion business and wanted to start things off right, with a show that he knew would be successful. He booked Fleetwood Mac because he knew the musicians from their previous U.S. tours. But when five unfamiliar people arrived at the venue with Davis, Engler asked, "Where's Fleetwood Mac?" Davis said this was the band. Engler declared that they were not the band, and furthermore, he wasn't going to let them on his stage. At this point, Davis took a swing at him. And after security separated them, told Engler that his new agency would have trouble with people in New York if Fleetwood Mac did not perform. Engler decided to let the show go ahead, and the audience was surprisingly receptive. A quote from Engler, "The band were really good. I don't know if the crowd was just really stoned or didn't know what Fleetwood Mac looked like." But several audience members did recognize the deception and demanded refunds. The tour continued on through January. On January 25th, they performed at the Clarkson College of Technology in Potsdam, New York. A paper called The Interrogator published a review of the show and even included a picture of the band on stage, the only picture I've seen of the band. The British rock band Silverhead, fronted by Michael DeBar, was the opening band for much of the tour, and the reviewer did not appreciate the band. A quote from the review, "If a band is going to be so loud that it makes my ears howl in pain, it had better be good. Not so with Silverhead. What they did has all been done before, and I just as soon not hear it again." The reviewer goes on, "Fleetwood Mac was good, but not great. They survived three power losses very professionally and really got moving towards the end of the show. I had but one complaint, much too loud." I found another review of the show in a paper called The Raquette. This is the review. "You know, it's been a long time since I've gone to a concert here, and after last Friday's spectacle, it may be longer yet before I see another. It's not so much the music that'd keep me away, but those little extras that made the night so, quote, enjoyable. General consensus has it that the concert was much too loud. I agree. Since when does music have to be ear-popping loud to be enjoyed? Granted, the acts booked sound best loud, but I didn't bargain for split eardrums the following 2 days. Perhaps next time around someone could cut the decibel level, save a little juice, and soothe my senses rather than torment them. Musically, I dug the concert. I thought Silverhead was good, although being familiar with the group, that opinion may be biased. It seemed to me the main shortcoming of the group lay in the audience's apathy. It seems Potsdam is a little too conservative for a jumpin' band, and this was demonstrated constantly by refusal to stand up and boogie along with the band at the lead vocalist's request. How can you expect the band to put full out for a dead crowd? Their vocalist sure didn't appear too pleased with the reception. In fact, he looked pretty disgusted and took it from there. Fleetwood Mac fared better with the crowd and at least got them on their feet. Although a revision of the original Fleetwood Mac, the group's material came off well despite a sit-in drummer who turned out to be very good. Don't get me wrong in thinking that one should get up and boogie at every gig, but when a band asks the audience to boogie, why not boogie? A performance is a two-way street. Bands like to know people are out there getting off on the music and not just toking their brains out. One closing comment. People gotta be a lot cooler waiting in line to get in before an appearance. Why push and shove? You'll get in. I, for one, don't particularly like being dragged completely off my feet through the door by the crowd. And let's not be such an asshole next time with the snowballs, okay? Somebody had a pretty mean arm up front there, but somebody could have gotten hurt. The next night, Fleetwood Mac and Silverhead brought the tour to the Academy of Music in New York City. By this time, the story of the fake Fleetwood Mac was circulating within the music industry, and Rolling Stone sent a reporter to cover the New York show. Clifford Davis was interviewed at the venue and boldly proclaimed, "This band is my band. I've always been the leader of the band as such." He claimed that Mick Fleetwood had flown to the U.S. on January 13th with the intention of being on the tour, but had to return home the next day because of family troubles. The show turned out to be a disaster. Gantry claimed that he had lost his voice. Rolling Stone noted that the venue and the promoters were not made aware of Gantry's vocal problems until after the opening set by the local band Kiss, when it was too late to cancel the show and give refunds to the audience. That's right, Kiss opened the show. It was something like their 28th gig and the second and final time that Paul Stanley performed live with his alternate bandit makeup design. Billboard magazine actually published a review of Kiss's performance on February 9, 1974. Quote, Kiss, a native New York group about to embark on the concert circuit after playing local bars for over a year, opened the show. Their set proved to be a lot more ear-shattering than it was earth-shattering. Wearing black leather and studs and white theatrical makeup, they rely heavily on visual effects. Their set climaxed with the drummer soaring high above the stage on a hidden hydraulic lift while synchronized magnesium flares are ignited and the bassist arches a flaming torch in the air. We'll be right back. While the promoters argued with Davis and the band backstage, Silverhead had to fill the time by playing a 90-minute set to a chorus of boos. A New York Times reviewer dryly noted that this was, quote, not to the advantage of the British group, which found its basic rock style stretched a little thin.
until I'll see you again soon.
Finally, it was agreed that the band billed as Fleetwood Mac would fulfill its contractual obligations by playing a set of instrumentals, and the 3,000 people in attendance were treated to a series of extended blues jams. The New York Times Review noted that, quote, Fleetwood Mac has completely changed personnel since its last New York visit. A few minutes after midnight, Clifford Davis took the microphone and told the audience, quote, We're going to try to work out something with the promoter to come back in March. The tour moved onward into February. Interestingly, at the same time, a group called Buckingham Nicks were on a tour of the East Coast, but this version of Fleetwood Mac was heading for the West Coast. On the way, they stopped in Twin Falls, Idaho on February 6th. A headline in the Omaha World Herald on February 17th talked about a lawsuit that this concert inspired. The headline, Imposters Staged Concert. The article read, About 3,000 paid between $4.50 and $6 to see the rock group Fleetwood Mac in concert. What they got, according to a suit, was a group of masquerading musicians. A complaint filed in the 4th District Court by state officials has asked for restraining orders against promoters of the concerts last week in Twin Falls and Boise. On February 8th, the tour made it to Portland, Oregon, where Tim Buckley also opened the show. A headline in the Oregonian, Tickets Up for Refunds. The article reads, A controversy over musicians in the English rock band Fleetwood Mac, scheduled to play the Paramount Northwest Theater Friday, has caused the theater to grant ticket refunds to those desiring them. The next night, February 9th, the band played in Seattle with Status Quo opening. They moved on to Salt Lake City, and on February 14th ended up at Chico State College in Chico, California. A reviewer of this show wrote that, quote, Five guys named Mo played to a half-empty auditorium, and angry audience members stormed the box office and were told, quote, Sign this list, kid, and you'll be mailed a full refund. The band had the next two nights booked at the Winterland in San Francisco, but they canceled. It's impossible to know how many of the remaining February and March booked concerts were actually performed, but the band did make it up to Canada, where Status Quo opened another show in Edmonton on February 20th. And supposedly, on April 6th, they played in St. Louis, supported by Nazareth. Over the course of March, they were supposed to have played in Virginia, Missouri, Vermont, Pennsylvania, Florida, Michigan, Texas. I'm not sure how many of those concerts actually took place. On February 28, 1974, an article about the controversy was published in Rolling Stone magazine. I'm going to read part of the article here. Quote, The drummer, according to Davis, substituted at the last moment for Mick Fleetwood on this tour. It was at the end of the last tour in August, said Davis, that, quote, I just decided it was time to change the band, certainly on stage, and that's what I did. I've always been sort of the leader. I've always sort of picked who was going to be in it and who wasn't. I decided to keep Mick. But, Davis claimed, trouble at home forced Mick to fly right back to England the day after he arrived in America, on January 13th. So Davis quickly flew over Craig, a friend of the other musicians, to fill in. Davis said that before each show he is informing the audience that Mick had personal problems and had to return home. However, informed sources say that Fleetwood was never booked to fly to America and that he did not come to the States at all. Bob Welch, the American guitarist who joined Fleetwood Mac 2.5 years ago when original member Jeremy Spencer found God in Los Angeles, denied the whole Davis story and that press time was en route to England to meet with Fleetwood, the McVees, Weston, and lawyers to straighten the whole matter out. Said Welch on the phone before he left California, quote, It's a ripoff. The manager put together a group real fast using the name Fleetwood Mac before we had a chance to do anything about it. Both Fleetwood and Welch have said that around this time, Davis sent a letter to the members of the real Fleetwood Mac, saying that he wanted to put the band back on the road as a part of a star-studded new project, and offering them those U.S. tour dates. But all of them turned him down, because they were not ready to go back on the road again. Some sources indicate that the new recruits were led to believe they were joining a new version of the ever-changing Fleetwood Mac lineup, possibly because Davis allegedly told them that Fleetwood and Christine McVie would be coming on board once the tour began. Fleetwood Mac collectively filed lawsuits to stop the tour, and Clifford Davis countersued, claiming that he owned the band's name and that because he also held the copyright to all the band's previous recordings, he had the right to choose who would play those songs live. So I actually interviewed the drummer of this version of Fleetwood Mac, Craig Collinge, and we're going to hear some of that interview right now. So you were brought in basically at the last minute to replace Mick Fleetwood, right?
So I don't know whether it was the last minute, but I was rung up by the Clifford Davis organization. I guess it was an organization at the time, and asked me to come on down and have a play. I had been already had worked with the Manfred Mann Chapter 3 band and Third World War band that was kind of popular, not popular, they were cultish bands in England, and another band, Alan Price, which, you know, he was doing all the stuff. So they asked me to come on down and have a play with the idea that they didn't actually tell me what band it was, but they told me the basic background of it, that I would be rehearsing for 6 weeks, I think it was, and then off to America to do the first gig. I think it was in Pittsburgh, but I may be wrong, Pittsburgh or somewhere like that. And that was the first gig. And then when I did the initial audition, if you like, Clifford Davis came on down and spoke to me and said, well, look, the band will be called, will be Fleetwood Mac, and Mick Fleetwood's on holiday or he's doing this or doing that, and you will get for him, but he will join at some stage, but we're not 100% sure when it will be. So that was my understanding of it. And I got a retainer, basically a retainer, for playing in the band. So it wasn't big bickies, but it was enough at the time to sustain me and sort of family members, sort of thing, you know. So it was, you know, we weren't making millions, but I was making, you know, I was on a retainer. So, my understanding was that I was just basically depping for Mick Fleetwood for 6 weeks or something like that, and then I would return to England and they would carry on with Mick Fleetwood. Well, that didn't actually happen, but anyhow, that was that's how I was to understand how it would work.
Okay, that's interesting. So it was always presented to you as just a substitution role, and Mick was still the drummer in the band, and you were just filling in for him for this short tour, basically.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. Roughly six-week tour of America.
And so what was the set list like? Was it mostly Fleetwood Mac songs, or were there a lot of cover songs in there, too?
My memory goes that we did do... Albatross was reasonably well-known, and we did a couple of other blues things. And then there was a couple of other things that I think were... They must have been covers. I'm pretty sure that they were... but they were in that kind of blues roots tradition.
Yeah.
But I know that Albatross was a Peter Green composition. That was the one that I think it was a minor hit, or whether it was a minor hit in America, I don't know, but I know it was a minor hit in England. Well, might have even been almost a major hit, because I think it was a single. So that was a hit. Albatross, that was an instrumental. Don't know whether you recall that one. Yeah, okay.
So as it was a pickup band of all, you know, veteran musicians, it was probably didn't require a lot of rehearsal time. You guys could probably just head out on tour without a lot of rehearsal.
Well, that was how I felt about it. Whether the other guys had played together, you mentioned Kirby and you mentioned Elmer Gantry. Maybe they had worked together. I don't know much about Paul Martinez, where he came from, whether he was working with them, but. Yeah, well, we had, obviously, it was supposedly a tight band after 6 weeks. But, look, I was never really fully committed to the music. I mean, that sort of thing was something. Well, I was doing a job of work. I was doing a professional job of work. And so I just, you know, went and played at the time. I needed to go and work. And, of course, I was touring America, which I wanted to do. I mean, if nothing else, there was... Well, I mentioned it to John, the sex, drugs, and rock and roll. I liked the sex, but the drugs and the rock and roll didn't really interest me that much.
So as far as the itinerary of the tour went, did it kind of go off the rails, or did you, were you playing all the gigs that were scheduled, or were you picking up gigs along the way, or how did the scheduling?
Oh, no. The schedule was well known to all of us before we went. So, you know, on Wednesday we'll be in blah blah blah, or on Thursday we'll be blah blah blah. This will be the motel. So nothing was changed from that point of view. It was just that behind the scenes there was obviously a lot of I was involved in the. I can only pick up what was happening, but there was a lot of bad vibes, if you like, for want of a word, or two words, they were felt as though they were cheated. In other words, some of the promoters probably felt that they were cheated, and perhaps the audience as well.
Yeah, do you remember getting a lot of pushback from promoters and club owners?
Well, all I remember is that behind the scenes, Clifford Davis, who was probably with us a lot of the time, was fending off lots of criticism. And that's why when, after about 6 weeks, I can't remember what our last gig was, might have been in Los Angeles, but I haven't got the itinerary in front of me. You probably do. I know that there is there is an itinerary for it, but I know after about 6 weeks, we all then went back to the UK. So it's folded after about six weeks, I think.
It was cut short.
It was cut short, yeah. That's right. So there was supposedly another 3 or 4 weeks involved. That was cut short. We were supposed to go to Chicago from memory, and I think that was the end of the tour. And obviously from that time on, as we got back, there were lawsuits and all that sort of stuff. I didn't get involved. They bought me, Fleetwood Mac bought me a new drum kit, which I've still got.
Cool.
I don't play it these days. Yeah, I play mostly the piano when I'm playing anything. But I've still got the drum kit that was bought for me. I'm looking at it. So they bought me that. They paid me. I didn't have any qualms about, you know, anything else except that I knew that there were all sorts of friction, all sorts of problems behind the scenes.
Yeah. I've read, do you remember Clifford Davis actually going up on stage and arguing with audiences? Because I've read it seems like there's a couple of stories about that.
Well, now you bring it up, I've got a funny feeling there was some, but I can't remember where that was. I don't know whether it was an argument, but there was obviously there were people felt as though they were cheated. They'd paid their money to see what they thought was Fleetwood Mac, and they got this new band that they hadn't seen before. So look, I can understand that. But when you mentioned it, I thought there was a time there that someone, whether it was Clifford, I can't remember, got up and was trying to argue, if you like, the case of the new Fleetwood Mac. But my memory of that isn't all that clear. There could have very well been.
So were there actually instances of where the band would walk out on stage and the audience would maybe start yelling or booing or anything like that?
Well, I do remember, a few occasions, and I certainly remember in Canada, actually, I think it was Edmonton, Calgary or somewhere, where we played, and I thought I saw, it wasn't, but I thought I saw gunshots on the thing. It wasn't that. It was just studs when they were knocking the bloody stage, and they put these big hammer nail thing in there, and of course, but yes, there was obviously... the audience were alienated, from upset that they thought they were getting swindled.
Right. Well, and at that time, Fleetwood Mac was actually kind of a cultish band, like a lot of musicians and kind of very, you know, serious music fans would have been going to these shows, you know, not just like a casual crowd, you know what I mean?
Yeah, well, they would have had, as I said before, the pop part of Fleetwood Mac with Lindsey Buckingham and all those sort of people, that came a few years later.
Right.
Probably 75, 76, or maybe, yeah, roughly about that time when they had thing like Rumours. But the band Fleetwood Mac was basically a blues roots, originally, yeah, blues roots band.
Yeah. So how surprised were you by the success of Fleetwood Mac, you know, a couple of years later after this tour happened?
Well, do you know, I hate to say this, but I had done a job. I wasn't interested in that music at all,
right,
really. So I was really depping and doing a job of work. And then I left England about, when did I leave? Probably about not much later than that period. So probably by the time they were successful, I was back in Australia. And and that was just a distant memory for me, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's just interesting that this tour we're talking about is kind of, you know, the whole Fleetwood Mac organization was about as bad off as it could possibly have been, like just completely a disaster zone. And within a couple of years, they're the biggest band in the world. It's pretty crazy the turnaround that actually occurred there, you know?
Yeah, well, as I say, look, hits are everything, aren't they? I mean, really,
yeah.
How many times have we seen bands and people in bands being, you know, taken into court for illicit drugs or something, and the next minute they have a hit and everyone's forgotten about it? I mean, that's what happens, and it happens in all sorts of areas, politics, and it happens everywhere. You know, one minute they're a villain, the next minute they're a hero. But, I mean, that's the thing with Fleetwood Mac was that they had the big hit with Rumours. As I say, by this time I was back in Australia, and Fleetwood Mac was only, you know, it was another band that I had worked with.
Yeah.
And I don't even know what I used. Maybe that's what Elmer Gantry's worried about. I mean, I don't even think I used the Fleetwood Mac as part of any kind of resume that I would have used.
Right.
It was just one of those things that I did at the time. But, you know, years later, all of a sudden, you're doing a podcast, John's doing a podcast. So all of a sudden, that seems to be, you know, kind of interest to people. I don't know why, but that's, you know, that's the way it is. You know, years later, probably it's seen as a kind of a milestone of some description.
Yeah. Well, so you were together for about 6 weeks. Did everybody get along? Like, as, you know, the group of guys that were on the road together, was there camaraderie?
As I say, we worked together as a rehearsal group for 6 weeks in London, mainly around the Shepherd's Bush Chalk Farm area, and that was the rehearsal area. Then we went on this tour. But when we got on the tour, and of course the all sorts of innuendos about the new fleet was back on the bat, you know, as we became sort of villainous. I didn't really get on particularly. I mean, I didn't I got on well enough with Elmer. He had a good sense of humor, but I wasn't really close to the others. Now, bearing in mind, particularly Paul and Dave, as soon as you arrive in these places and it's Fleetwood Mac, they give you everything, you know, on the table. You know, you get your hire cars and you get your drugs and your your girls and your and everything else. So I think in some cases, particularly Paul and Dave, finished. You know, they indulged in the point where in some cases they were a bit, you know, not really of interest in terms of being able to articulate much apart from where's the next drug. We weren't close to begin with.
Yeah, right.
And I'd come from, as I say, I'd come from a different musical background. And that being the case, I wasn't all that interested in the music, although they probably were. So, you know, that made it different. But as I say, I fitted in because I more or less had to fit in because it was a job for me for 6 weeks.
Was it Clifford Davis that asked you to come? How did he know to ask you? How did your name come get into the mix? Do you know?
Well, I really don't know about that, but all I know is that I'd had a variety of well-known band experience in England. Okay. As I mentioned before, the Massive Band,
True.
Chapter
right.
3,
right.
The Third World War. So there was a someone had mentioned someone. Why don't you ask Craig? I don't know. Sometimes you don't know how this all works. I didn't know the other guys. But someone must have said, oh, we must get hold of Craig and see if he wants to do it. I don't know. Maybe they tried half a dozen others.
Right.
And they just, I don't know.
What was Clifford Davis like to work with?
Well, he was like, you probably don't get that show. There was an English show called, I can't remember. But anyhow, it was based around a East End kind of Fargo East End spiff, as they used to call them. Oh, he was rather like that. The East End kind of came up probably the hard way, and so he thought he'd make money out of music, out of the rock and roll thing. Somehow he must have met Peter Green on somewhere down the track.
Yeah,
they concocted the name Fleetwood Mac, and that's why Clifford Davis thought he had a pretty good and tight legal stand for the name.
Right. I guess one last thing I want to ask you about is when you played in New York at the Academy of Music, the band Kiss actually opened the show. Do you remember anything about that?
I do.
You do?
I vaguely remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do. What I did remember is the drums being circulated. So the drummer was on a sort of a stand and he got, they were playing. We didn't see much of the show, but we saw enough of it to say, well, what's this all about? But yeah, they had an audience there and obviously an audience of Kiss fans. So, and we were, I would have thought, completely different to Kiss. So it was kind of interesting. Mix, but yeah, they were on the show, and they, as you say, opened up the show, and it was really quite what I would have called almost like a circus act, I thought at the time.
yeah. Did he breathe fire at that show?
You know, it was sort of that sort of thing. You
yeah,
know? It was. I mean, obviously, they had again hits. And they became one of the biggest bands of that time, later down probably a year or two later. But, you know, as I saw them at the time, it was kind of like a circus act. So it didn't make a great deal of musical sense to me.
Yeah, that was one of their first shows. They didn't even have a record out yet in January of 74. So you played the pretty big crowds, right? Like, I know the show in New York when Kiss opened was over 3,000 people. So,
oh yeah, I mean, as I say, Fleetwood Mac still had, as you mentioned before, had a cult following,
yeah,
and so yeah, so there was a big crowd. I mean, a big enough crowd, but as I said before, they obviously were very disappointed that they weren't getting what they thought was the Fleetwood Mac that they paid for, I guess.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me, Craig. I really appreciate it.
Not at all, Brian, but if you can send us the link eventually when you get it all together, that would be lovely. We'll keep in touch that way, huh?
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, sounds good.
So there is a story out there, and I think Mick Fleetwood actually admitted to it, that the whole thing was a ruse concocted by Fleetwood in order to trick Clifford Davis into putting a fake band out on the road. Then they could sue him, get this into the courts, and reclaim the rights to the name Fleetwood Mac. And that's what happened. They ended up settling out of court, and Mick Fleetwood and John McVie came away with the rights to the name Fleetwood Mac. In later years, Mick Fleetwood actually said that in the end, he was grateful to Davis because the lawsuit was the reason that the band moved to California.
This is a story from the April 25th, 1974 issue of Rolling Stone. Quote, "If this case goes on any longer," said Mick Fleetwood, "I'll end up talking like a lawyer." Fleetwood was referring to the action brought by members of Fleetwood Mac to prevent former manager Clifford Davis from using the group's name for another set of musicians who recently toured America. The holdup in legal proceedings stems from Davis's apparent reticence to tell his account of what happened. "He's had 6 weeks so far," said Fleetwood, "and the judge may give him another week or so, but it seems he's finding it hard to give an answer. The group is confident about the eventual judgment." "He can't stop us using the name," said Fleetwood, "but we could certainly stop him." The band is anxious to settle quickly so they can go to Los Angeles to work on a new LP and plan a U.S. tour, but Fleetwood will see the suit to its conclusion. "I think Davis thought we wouldn't be bothered to fight his takeover," said Mick, "particularly as I'd been through a state of emotional trauma. But we'll see it through to the end, even if it makes us go broke. So many managers seem to forget who is employing who and who makes the money. They forget it's the people who bash the drums and twang the guitars. You see, it's not just vindictiveness. It's that he tried to take our livings away, smeared us as being fools for even letting this situation develop." During the recent tour of the Davis-hired Fleetwood Mac, audiences greeted the band with hostility, demands for refunds, and, in Boise, Idaho, with complaints filed with the Attorney General's office. Davis, who was on that tour, maintained that he was Fleetwood Mac and could hire and fire as he pleased. He had not informed promoters that his band included none of the Fleetwood Mac from previous tours and recent albums. Of 39 scheduled concerts, 4 were known to have been canceled as promoters learned of what Davis called the new Fleetwood Mac. Fleetwood's explanation of Davis's behavior is that, after being told by the band that they didn't want to tour until they decided, he considered the possible loss of income and formed the new Fleetwood Mac. "We have letters from him stating he had the right to the name. He said that he sacked the band before Christmas and then offered me a job on a wage basis. He has no right. The band is a registered company which employed Davis. What an insult. John and I were the band when it started, way before he came on the scene." "Meantime," said Mick Fleetwood, "his group will work without a manager. We'll look after ourselves with a good accountant and lawyer. If something is too complicated for us to arrange, then we just won't do it. You can bet I'll never sign anything that's binding for longer than 3 months." After the courts ruled that the Fleetwood Mac name belonged to Mick Fleetwood and John McVie, the two band members set up their own band management company, CD Management. Warner Brothers made a new deal with Fleetwood Mac, releasing the album Heroes Are Hard to Find on Reprise in September of 1974.
But Bob Welch was suffering with personal and professional issues. His marriage was failing and he felt exhausted. He resigned from the band in December of 1974. Fleetwood Mac had become a punchline in the industry. It became a joke for bands to check into hotels as Fleetwood Mac. Led Zeppelin, who were banned from many hotel chains for destroying their rooms, were checking into hotels as Fleetwood Mac.
Now, we were actually, as the Faces, we were banned from all Holiday Inns, so we used to check in as Fleetwood Mac. Before Fleetwood Mac were particularly
good. Well, I was going to say, they put a shift in.
You know, we'd announce that we're having a party back at the Holiday Inn.
And, on stage?
Yeah, on stage, and everybody would flock back, and we let most of the girls in, not all the men.
But then, Mick Fleetwood visited Sound City Studios.
Where I met Keith Olsen, and introduced myself. He said, this is the studio. Oh, and this, very lackadaisical, and this is something that I made in this studio, so at least you can hear what the room sounds like. And it was the Buckingham Nicks album, Stevie and Lindsay. We went into a mode where, when Bob decided to leave, there was absolutely not even anything more than I had heard Lindsay's guitar playing. And my immediate thing was, well, I'm going to find out who that guy was, which is what I did.
She asked me to join, but I said, well, you know, we're sort of a package.
The thing was is that they needed a guitar player bad enough to say, well, you know, we'll take her. If she's good, good. If she's not, she's gone, you know.
Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks officially joined Fleetwood Mac on New Year's Eve, 1974. The self-titled Fleetwood Mac album was released in July of 1975. The album hit number one over a year after entering the Billboard charts and spent 37 weeks in the top 10 and more than 15 months in the top 40. At this point, the album is certified 7 times platinum in the United States, and the next album, Rumors, 20 times platinum. But what happened to the other Fleetwood Mac? Well, 3 of its members, Elmer Gantry, Kirby Gregory, and Paul Martinez, along with a drummer named Jim Russell, continued on, calling themselves Stretch. Clifford Davis got them a record deal. Quote, I set up Stretch to thank them for helping Mick Fleetwood and me out of a very delicate situation. Stretch's first single, the funky Why Did You Do It, which we heard at the beginning of the episode, became a surprise top 20 hit in the UK. Mick Fleetwood characterized the lyrics of the song as, quote, a direct attack on me for not showing up for the bogus tour, which I'd never promised to do in the first place.
Why did you do it? Why did you do that thing to me? The only one who knows the truth, man, that's him, me and you. My friends, they listen to the things I say. They listen and they hear more every day. I know they never understand it, because it was no accident, you planned it. Why did you do it? Why did you do that thing to me? Why did you do it? Why did you do that thing to me? Truth, man, that's him, me and you. 1, 2. We'll be right back.
Drummer Jim Russell left the band before the recording of the second album, You Can't Beat Your Brain for Entertainment, and was replaced by future Status Quo drummer Jeff Rich. Elmer Gantry left before the making of the last album, Forget the Past. And now, to play us out...
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with a song by Stretch. So this is three of the guys from the fake Fleetwood Mac. Basically, the band continued on, just called themselves Stretch, put out three albums. We're going to hear a song from their first album, Elastique, which came out in 1975. This is called Miss Dizzy.
Stardust in her silky hair, blowing tacky kisses when the crowd is there. Don't you know she can't make it, can't fake it. She's so square, yeah, yeah. Nervous introduction.
Back.